internal political matters there. Truman said he was extremely pleased. But Stalin, as if to be sure Truman understood, repeated that by the middle of August the Red Army would be in the war with Japan, as agreed at Yalta, to which Truman expressed his every confidence that the Soviets would keep their word. At this point, Harry Vaughan slipped into the room to ask Truman in a whisper if he was going to invite these guys to lunch. "What was on the menu?" Truman whispered. "Liver and bacon," Vaughan said. "If liver and bacon is good enough for us, it's good enough for them," Truman replied. When he asked Stalin to stay, Stalin protested, saying it would be impossible. "You could if you wanted to," Truman said. And Stalin stayed. For creamed spinach soup, liver and bacon, baked ham, julienne potatoes, string beans, pumpernickel bread, jam, sliced fruit, mints, candy, cigars, which Stalin declined, and a California wine that he went out of his way to praise. Truman thought the whole occasion went well, exactly because it was so spur-of-the-moment and informal. He liked Stalin, he decided. "And I felt hopeful that we could reach an agreement satisfactory to the world and to ourselves." But Stalin nearly always made a good impression on foreigners. Churchill, who once called Russia a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma, and who warned both Roosevelt and Truman repeatedly of the Russian menace to Europe, confessed still to liking Stalin the man. Roosevelt had been convinced almost to the end that he could get along with Uncle Joe. "The truth is," wrote Jimmy Burns, recalling Stalin's performance at Yalta, "he is a very likable person." Joseph E. Davies, who had been ambassador to Russia briefly and would be at Truman's side daily at the Potsdam conference table, had said in a superficial and immensely popular book, Mission to Moscow, published in 1941, that Stalin was uncommonly wise and gentle. "A child would like to sit on his lap, and a dog would sidle up to him," wrote Davies. Even Eisenhower, after a visit to Moscow later that summer, would describe Stalin in much the same fashion as benign and fatherly. Truman, as he wrote, found Stalin to be polite, good-natured, businesslike, honest, but smart as hell. There had not been a hint of contention between them. The conference hadn't even begun, yet already Truman had achieved his main objective, as he recorded triumphantly in his diary. "He'll be in the Jap War on August 15th. Feeny Japs when that comes about. I can deal with Stalin." That Stalin was also secretive to the point of imbalance, suspicious, deceitful, unspeakably cruel, that he ruled absolutely and by terror and secret police, that he was directly responsible for destroying millions of his own people and the enslavement of many millions more, was not so clearly understood by the outside world at this point as it would be later. Still, the evil of the man was no secret in 1945. In a February issue, published just before Yalta, Time magazine had noted that Stalin and his regime had deliberately caused the deaths by starvation of at least 3 million peasants and liquidated another 1 million communists who opposed his policies. "Facts are stubborn things," said the article, borrowing a line from Lenin, "and these were the facts." Actually, the facts were more horrible. Probably 5 million peasants had died. Probably 10 million had been sent to forced labor camps. "I was remembering my friends," the composer Shostakovich once remarked, "and all I saw was corpses. Mountains of corpses." Stalin himself had told Churchill in 1942 that 10 millions of peasants had been dealt with. At one point in 1940, during the Hitler-Stalin Pact, he had had many thousands of Polish officers murdered in what became known as the Katyn Forest Massacre. In truth, Uncle Joe was one of the great mass murderers of all time, as much as Ivan the Terrible, his favorite czar, as much nearly as Adolf Hitler. Yet, wrote Bolin, there was little in Stalin's demeanor in the presence of foreigners that gave any clue of the real nature and character of the man. Stalin had perfected a talent for disguise. At Tehran, at Yalta, at Potsdam, and during the 10 days I saw him during the spring of 1945 with Hopkins, Stalin was exemplary in his behavior. He was patient, a good listener, always quiet in his manner and in his expression. There were no signs of the harsh and brutal nature behind this mask. The mask was the artifice of an accomplished actor, and it rarely slipped. Once was at Tehran. Churchill had been arguing that a premature opening of a second front in France would result in an unjustified loss of tens of thousands of Allied soldiers. Stalin responded, "When one man dies, it is a tragedy. When thousands die, it's statistics." 20 years in politics had taught him a thing or two about people, Truman thought. He had only to look a man in the eye to know. "I was impressed by him," he would write of Stalin, remembering this first meeting. "What I most especially noticed were his eyes, his face, and his expression." With the lunch over and the opening session of the conference not scheduled to begin until 5 o'clock, Truman went upstairs in the nightmare house and took a nap. Section 3. The first of the plenary sessions of the Potsdam Conference, last of the wartime meetings of the Big Three, codenamed Terminal, was held in the Cecilienhof Palace at Potsdam, the former summer residence of Crown Prince Wilhelm of Prussia, which had served more recently as a military hospital, first for the Germans, then the Russians. A sprawling, two-story, ivy-covered stone building in the Neo-Tudor style, it looked very like a vast English country house, with gardens extending to the lake, and an inner court where the Russians had planted a giant star of red geraniums. The oak-paneled reception hall, a cavernous, dim space lit by heavy wrought-iron chandeliers, served as the conference room. The color scheme was dark red, black and gold, and the effect rather foreboding, except for one immense window 2 stories tall looking onto the gardens and lake. At the center of the room was a circular conference table 12 feet in diameter, covered in a burgundy cloth, and around it, evenly spaced, were 15 chairs, 5 each for the 3 countries. The 3 chairs reserved for Churchill, Stalin, and Truman were immediately identifiable by their larger size and an incongruous pair of gilded cupids perched on the back of each. Additional chairs and several small desks were arranged in a larger circle behind, these for other members of the delegation, advisors, and specialists who would come and go as different topics arose. To enter the room, the 3 leaders had their own separate doors, each of these heavily guarded by Russian soldiers. When everybody was assembled, the guards withdrew. The doors were closed. Though wearing the same gray suit as earlier, Truman had put on a fresh white shirt and a bow tie. Churchill, like Stalin, was in a summer-weight khaki uniform, and as they took their places, he lit up an 8-inch cigar. Stalin was carrying a briefcase, which he tossed onto the table, as if to say he was ready for business. Truman sat with Burns and Leahy on his right, Bolin and Davies on the left. In Churchill's group now was Clement Attlee, Churchill's Labour Party opponent in the general election, whom the Prime Minister had decided to include in the national interest, in the event that Attlee turned out to be his successor. Never in history has such an aggregation of victorious military force been represented at one conference, wrote the New York Times. Never has there been a meeting which faced graver or more complex issues, and never have three mortal men borne so heavy a responsibility for the welfare of their peoples and mankind. No correspondents for the Times were present, however, nor any of the nearly 200 other reporters who had made their way to Berlin to cover the story and were, as Churchill said, in a state of furious indignation. For the lid was on at Potsdam. Everything conducted behind a ring of bayonets, as Stalin had insisted. Even the number of authorized people permitted in the room at any one time was strictly limited. Once, when Burns's secretary brought him some papers and had to wait a few minutes, two women from the Russian staff entered immediately and took chairs until she left. The conference was officially called to order at 5:10 p.m. Stalin spoke first, saying that President Truman, as the only head of state present, should preside. Churchill seconded the proposal. Truman expressed his appreciation. Then, as in his first speech to Congress, he plunged directly into his prepared remarks, moving rapidly down an item-by-item order of business that he thought the conference should follow. He proposed the establishment of a Council of Foreign Ministers to make the necessary preparations for a peace conference. Immediately, Stalin was dubious, questioning any participation by China in a European peace settlement. Truman submitted a draft on how the administration of Germany should be handled. Churchill said he had had no opportunity to examine it. Truman read a prepared statement on implementation of the Yalta Declaration, which pledged the three powers to assist the people of all liberated European countries to establish democratic governments through free election. He was wasting no time getting to the sorest of subjects. "Since the Yalta Conference," he read, "the obligations assumed under this declaration have not been carried out." Of particular concern were Romania, Bulgaria, and Greece. Again, Churchill said he needed time to consider the document. Truman moved quickly on, calling for a change in policy toward Italy. As soon as possible, Italy must be included in the United Nations. Churchill now protested and, to make his point, invoked the memory of Roosevelt. "They were trying to deal with too many important matters too hastily," said Churchill. He reminded Truman that Italy had attacked Britain at the time France was going down and that Roosevelt himself had called this a stab in the back. The British had fought the Italians for 2 years in Africa before American forces ever arrived. Truman paused, as if brought up short by the mere mention of Roosevelt. Speaking more slowly now, he said he appreciated the honor of having been made chairman of the meeting. He had come to the conference with certain trepidation, he said. He had to replace a man who was irreplaceable. He knew full well the goodwill and friendship Roosevelt had achieved with the Prime Minister and the Generalissimo, both for himself and for the United States. And he, Harry Truman, hoped he might merit the same friendship and goodwill as time went on. It was simply and well expressed, and what he should have said at the start. And the atmosphere changed at once, as Churchill responded in fulsome Churchillian fashion. Though no official verbatim record was being kept, Llewellyn Thompson from the American Embassy in London and Ben Cohen of Burns's staff were both taking notes. "Churchill," recorded Thompson, "said he should like to express on behalf of the British delegation his gratitude to the President for undertaking the presidency of this momentous conference, and to thank him for presenting so clearly the views of the mighty republic which he heads. The warm and ineffaceable sentiments which they had for President Roosevelt they would renew with the man who had come forward at this historic moment, and he wished to express to him his most cordial respect. He trusted that the bonds, not only between their countries but also between them personally, would increase. The more they came to grips with the world's momentous problems, the closer their association would become. On behalf of the Russian delegation, said Stalin, he wished to say they fully shared the sentiments expressed by the Prime Minister. It was a pattern that would prevail. Churchill rumbling on, Stalin being as direct and to the point as Truman. Taking his turn now, his voice very low, Stalin spoke in short segments, leaving ample pauses between, as one practiced in working with an interpreter. He wished to discuss acquisition of the German Navy, which was then in British hands, German reparations, the question of trusteeships for the Soviet Union, by which he meant colonies, the future of Franco-Spain, and the future of Poland. Churchill agreed that the Polish question was foremost, but said the agenda for the next session should be left to the foreign ministers to decide, Eden, Burns, and Molotov. Stalin and Truman concurred.
"So, tomorrow we will have prepared the points most agreeable," said Churchill.
"All the same, we will not escape the disagreeable," countered Stalin.
"We will feel our way up to them," said Churchill, who was ready to stop for the day.
Stalin turned again to the question of including China in preparations for the peace conference. Churchill thought it a needless complication to bring in China. Perhaps the matter could be referred to the foreign ministers, suggested Stalin, playing Churchill's game now. If the foreign secretaries decided to leave China out, said Truman, he had no objections.
As all the questions are to be discussed by the foreign ministers, we shall have nothing to do, observed Stalin, producing the first laughter at the table.
Churchill thought the foreign ministers ought to provide 3 or 4 points for discussion per day.
Enough to keep us busy.
Truman was on edge. This wasn't at all what he had come for.
I don't want to discuss, he said. I want to decide.
You want something in the bag each day,
Churchill responded, as if he were just now beginning to understand the new American president.
Yes, and next time he wished to begin at an earlier hour, Truman said.
I will obey your orders, responded Churchill.
And at once Stalin stepped in, his eyes on Churchill.
If you are in such an obedient mood today, Mr. Prime Minister, I should like to know whether you will share with us the German fleet.
The fleet should either be shared or destroyed, exclaimed Churchill. Weapons of war were horrible things.
Let's divide it, said Stalin. If Mr. Churchill wishes, he can sink his share.
The foreign secretary thought the prime minister's performance had been pathetic. The PM was woolly and verbose, and too much under Stalin's spell, noted Anthony Eden. And he let others know, which annoyed Truman, who took it as an act of disloyalty to Churchill. Alexander Cadogan, in a letter to his wife, said the PM simply talked too much, while Truman was admirably businesslike. It had made presiding over the Senate seem tame, Truman wrote to Bess, clearly pleased with himself and with the comments of his staff.
The boys say I gave them an earful. I hope so. Admiral Leahy said he'd never seen an abler job, and Burns and my fellows seemed to be walking on air. I was so scared I didn't know whether things were going according to Hoyle or not. Anyway, a start has been made, and I've gotten what I came for. Stalin goes to war August 15th with no strings on it. I'll say that we'll end the war a year sooner now. And think of the kids who won't be killed. That is the important thing. Wish you and Margie were here, but it is a forlorn place and would only make you sad.
The letter was written early on July 18th, before the day began. To his mother and sister, he wrote, "Churchill talks all the time, and Stalin just grunts, but you know what he means." Mama and Mary Jane had already written 6 times since he left Washington, and he would keep them posted through the entire conference. This morning, he had news he knew they would like. Sergeant Harry Truman, Vivian's oldest son, had joined him for breakfast. "He was on the Queen Elizabeth at Glasgow, ready to sail for New York. I told them to give him the choice of coming to the conference or going home. He elected to come and see me. I gave him a pass to Berlin signed by Stalin and by me. We'll send him home by plane, and he'll get there almost as soon as if he'd gone on the Elizabeth. He sure is a fine-looking soldier, stands up, dresses the part, and I'm proud of him." About mid-morning, Henry Stimson came in looking extremely excited. A second cable from George Harrison had arrived during the night. "Doctor had just returned, most enthusiastic and confident that the little boy is as husky as his big brother. The light in his eyes discernible from here to Highhold, and I could have heard his screams from here to my farm." The decoding officer at the Army Message Center had been amazed, assuming that the elderly Secretary of War had become a new father. Stimson explained the cable to Truman. The flash at Alamogordo had been visible for 250 miles. The distance from Washington to Highhold, Stimson's estate on Long Island. The sound carrying 50 miles. The distance to Harrison's farm in Virginia. Truman appeared extremely pleased, and at lunch with Churchill at Churchill's house, number 23 Ringstrasse, he showed him the 2 telegrams. "Stalin ought to be told," Truman offered. Churchill agreed that Stalin should know the great new fact, but none of the particulars. "Better to tell him sooner than later," Churchill suggested. "But how? In writing? Or by word of mouth? At a special meeting or informally?" Truman thought it best just to tell him after one of the meetings. He would wait for the right moment, Truman said. They were dining alone. Churchill lamented the melancholy state of Great Britain with its staggering debt and declining influence in the world. Truman said the United States owed Britain much for having held the fort at the beginning of the war. "If you had gone down like France," Truman told Churchill, "we might be fighting the Germans on the American coast at the present time." They talked of the war in the Pacific, and Churchill pondered whether new wording might be devised so that the Japanese could surrender and yet salvage some sense of their military honor. Truman countered by saying he did not think the Japanese had any military honor, not after Pearl Harbor. Churchill said that, at any rate, they had something for which they were ready to face certain death in very large numbers, and this might not be so important to us as it was to them. At this, Truman turned quite sympathetic, as Churchill recounted, and began talking of the terrible responsibilities upon him in regard to unlimited effusion of American blood. "He invited personal friendship and comradeship," Churchill wrote. "He seems a man of exceptional character." From the Churchill lunch, Truman went to pay a return call on Stalin, accompanied now by Burns and Bolin, and to his surprise found a second lunch waiting, an elaborate meal in his honor, which in Russian fashion called for numerous toasts. Stalin told Truman of the secret Japanese peace feeler, and passed the Sato message across the table. "It might be best," said Stalin, "to lull the Japanese to sleep, to say their request for a visit by Prince Konoye was too vague to answer. Truman said nothing to indicate he already knew of the Japanese overtures. He would leave the answer up to Stalin, he said. Bolin would remember Stalin's disclosure of the Japanese proposal making a very great impression on Truman, as a sign the Russians might be ready after all to deal openly with them. To his delight, Truman also discovered that Stalin, the supreme Soviet strongman, was substituting white wine for what was supposedly vodka in his glass. The Generalissimo must visit the United States, Truman said. If Stalin would come, Truman promised, he would send the battleship Missouri for him. He said he wanted to cooperate with the U.S. in peace as we had cooperated in war, but it would be harder, Truman recorded later. Said he was grossly misunderstood in U.S., and I was misunderstood in Russia. I told him that we each could remedy that situation in our home countries, and that I intended to try with all I had to do my part at home. He gave me a most cordial smile and said he would do as much in Russia. As the conference resumed that afternoon, Churchill again grew extremely long-winded. And though an outward show of friendship continued around the table, an edge of tension could also be felt. In an exchange with Truman, in a single sentence, Stalin hit on the hard reality underlying nearly every issue before them, the crux of so much of the frustration and divisiveness to come. "We cannot get away from the results of the war," said Stalin. The formal business was to be Germany, and Truman had suggested they begin at once. Churchill insisted on defining what was meant by Germany. If it meant Germany as geographically constituted before the war, then he agreed to discussion, his obvious point being that the Germany of the moment was one with eastern boundaries being determined by the position of the Red Army. Stalin, "Germany is what has become of her after the war. No other Germany exists." Truman, "Why not say the Germany of 1937? Stalin, "Minus what she has lost. Let us for the time being regard Germany as a geographical section." Truman, "But what geographical section?" Stalin, "We cannot get away from the results of the war." Truman, "But we must have a starting point." Stalin agreed. Churchill agreed. "So it is agreed that the Germany of 1937 should be the starting point," said Truman, as if they had made a major step forward. They turned to Poland, a subject that moved Churchill to talk longer even than usual, and so went the remainder of the session. Truman was exasperated. He could deal with Stalin, as he said, but Churchill was another matter. "I'm not going to stay around this terrible place all summer just to listen to speeches," he wrote that night. To Bess, earlier in the day, he had said Stalin's agreement to join in defeating Japan was what he came for. Now, his patience low at day's end, he wrote in his diary, "Believe Japs will fold up before Russia comes in. I am sure they will when Manhattan, the Manhattan Project, S1, appears over their homeland." At session three, the day after, there was sharp talk across the table, much of it from Truman. When the subject of the German Navy was raised again, he said he agreed to dividing the ships three ways, but only after the surrender of Japan. Merchant ships especially were needed. "We will need every bomb and every ton of food." On the future of Franco-Spain, a sore subject with Stalin, Truman said he had no love for Franco, nor had he any wish to take part in another civil war in Spain. "There have been enough wars in Europe." When the Yalta Declaration came up, Stalin insisted such matters be put off until another time. Truman was impatient for progress of almost any kind. He was homesick. "Sick of the whole business," he confided to Bess. The day was saved only by the party he gave that night. A banquet for Churchill and Stalin at No. 2 Kaiserstrasse, with music provided by a 27-year-old American concert pianist, Sergeant Eugene List, who was accompanied on the violin by Private First Class Stuart Cannon. Stalin was charmed. To the Americans present, it would remain the most memorable evening of the conference. The two musicians, both in uniform, had been flown in from Paris at Truman's request. The grand piano had been moved onto the back porch overlooking the lake, where, after dinner, in the lingering light of the summer evening, the whole party gathered. At one point, Truman himself played Paderewski's Minuet in G, the piece Paderewski had demonstrated for him in Kansas City 45 years earlier. But the highlight was Sergeant List's performance of the Chopin Waltz in A minor, Opus 42, which Truman had asked for specifically. List had not known the piece, nor had there been time to learn it. Later, in a letter to his wife, he described what happened when he asked if someone in the audience would be good enough to turn the pages of the music for him. A young captain in the party started toward the piano, mumbling something about not knowing how to read music, but that he would take a stab at it if I would tell him when to turn. Whereupon the president waved him aside with a sweeping gesture and volunteered to do the job himself. Just imagine! Well, you could have knocked me over with a toothpick. Thank goodness I was able to get through the waltz in creditable, if not sensational, manner, despite the general excitement and the completely unexpected appearance of President Truman in the role of page-turner. Imagine having the President of the United States turn pages for you. But that's the kind of man the President is. Truman was delighted to see Stalin so obviously enjoying himself. "The old man loves music," he told Bess. "Our boy was good." By Friday, the 20th, the week nearly over, there was still no further word on the test explosion in New Mexico. But when Truman invited Generals Eisenhower and Omar Bradley to lunch, the talk, according to Bradley's later account, focused on strategy in the Pacific and use of the atomic bomb. Bradley, a fellow Missourian, had never met Truman until now, and liked what he saw. He was direct, unpretentious, clear-thinking, and forceful. To Bradley, it seemed that Truman had already made up his mind to use the new weapon. Though neither Bradley nor Eisenhower was asked for an opinion, Eisenhower said he opposed use of the bomb. He thought Japan was already defeated. To Stimson, earlier, he had expressed the hope that the United States would not be the first to deploy a weapon so horrible. In time, however, Eisenhower would concede that his reaction was personal and based on no analysis of the subject. Eisenhower also advised Truman not to beg the Russians to come into the war with Japan, though he acknowledged that no power on earth could keep the Red Army out of that war unless victory came before they could get in. If Truman, as implied in his diary, truly believed that Manhattan would bring such victory instantly, this would have been the time for him to have said so. But he did not, which suggests either that he was still less than sure about the bomb, or that, contrary to Bradley's impression, he had still to make up his mind. "But all of us wanted Russia in the war," he would tell his daughter some years later. "Had we known what the bomb would do, we'd never have wanted the bear in the picture." Lunch over, accompanied by the two generals, Truman went again to Berlin, to the American sector this time, to speak at the raising of the flag that had flown over the Capitol in Washington the day Pearl Harbor was attacked. The ceremony took place in a small, cobbled square in glaring sunshine. Stimson and General Patton were present, the tall, theatrical Patton, resplendent in buckled riding boots, jodhpurs, and a lacquered four-star helmet. Patton seemed to glow from head to foot. There were stars on his shoulders, stars on his sleeves, more stars than Truman had ever seen on one human being, He counted 28. Truman spoke without notes and with obvious emotion, choosing his words carefully as he stood shoulders braced, thumbs hooked in the side pockets of his double-breasted suit, his eyes shadowed by his very unmilitary Western-style Stetson. It was his own kind of speech, exactly what his address to the United Nations was not, and the first public pronouncement by any of the big three since arriving in Germany. "We are here today to raise the flag of victory over the capital of our greatest adversary. We must remember that we are raising it in the name of the people of the United States, who are looking forward to a better world, a peaceful world, a world in which all the people will have an opportunity to enjoy the good things of life, and not just a few at the top. Let us not forget that we are fighting for peace and for the welfare of mankind. We are not fighting for conquest. There is not one piece of territory or one thing of a monetary nature that we want out of this war. We want peace and prosperity for the world as a whole." Here the thumbs came out of the coat pockets, his freed hands chopped the air in unison, the familiar gesture, as he stressed each word. "Peace and prosperity for the world as a whole. We want to see the time come when we can do the things in peace that we have been able to do in war. If we can put this tremendous machine of ours, which has made victory possible, to work for peace, we can look forward to the greatest age in the history of mankind. That is what we propose to do." It was not what Abraham Lincoln might have said, or what Robert Sherwood might have written for Franklin Roosevelt, but it was deeply moving, even for hard-shelled reporters and old soldiers. "What might easily have been made a routine patriotic display," wrote Raymond Daniel of the New York Times, "and hardly a day passes without one in Berlin, was turned into a historic occasion by the President's simple, homely declaration of the faith that had sent millions of American boys into battle far from home for a belief few of them could express." As no one had anticipated, Truman made it a moment of lasting inspiration to all of us who were there, recorded General Lucius D. Clay. "While the soldier is schooled against emotion," Clay wrote years later, "I have never forgotten that short ceremony as our flag rose to the staff." On the ride back, Truman was in a generous mood. Turning to Eisenhower, he said out of the blue, "General, there is nothing you may want that I won't try to help you get. That definitely and specifically includes the presidency in 1948. Bradley remembered trying to keep a straight face. Eisenhower looked flabbergasted. "Mr. President," he replied, "I don't know who will be your opponent for the presidency, but it will not be I." That night, recording his thoughts on the day's session at the conference table, Truman said only that Uncle Joe looked tired and drawn today, and the PM seemed lost. The main topic had been Italy. Little was accomplished. Before noon on Saturday, July 21st, Henry Stimson received by special courier the eagerly awaited report from General Groves, the first description of the first nuclear explosion, and, as Stimson said, an immensely powerful document. By early afternoon, he and General Marshall had reviewed it together, and at 3:30, Stimson brought it to the president. Burns was summoned. The doors were closed. Stimson began to read aloud in his scratchy old man's voice. "The test had been successful beyond the most optimistic expectations of anyone." The test bomb had not been dropped from a plane, but exploded on top of a 100-foot steel tower. The energy generated was estimated to be the equivalent of 15,000 to 20,000 tons of TNT.
For the first time in history, there was a nuclear explosion. And what an explosion! For a brief period, there was a lighting effect within a radius of 20 miles, equal to several suns in midday. A huge ball of fire was formed, which lasted for several seconds. This ball mushroomed and rose to a height of over 10,000 feet before it dimmed. The light from the explosion was seen clearly at Albuquerque, Santa Fe, Silver City, El Paso, and other points generally to about 180 miles away. The sound was heard to the same distance in a few instances, but generally to about 100 miles. Only few windows were broken, although one was some 125 miles away. A massive cloud was formed, which surged and billowed upward with tremendous power, reaching the substratosphere at an elevation of 41,000 feet, 36,000 feet above the ground, in about 5 minutes, breaking without interruption through a temperature inversion at 17,000 feet, which most of the scientists thought would stop it. Two supplementary explosions occurred in the cloud shortly after the main explosion. The cloud contained several thousand tons of dust picked up from the ground and a considerable amount of iron in the gaseous form. Our present thought is that this iron ignited when it mixed with the oxygen in the air to cause these supplementary explosions. High concentrations of highly radioactive materials resulted from the fission and were contained in this cloud. The report described how the steel from the tower had evaporated, and the greenish cast of the pulverized dirt in a crater more than 1,000 feet in diameter. 1/2 mile from the explosion, there was a massive steel test cylinder weighing 220 tons. The base of the cylinder was solidly encased in concrete. Surrounding the cylinder was a strong steel tower 70 feet high, anchored to concrete foundations. This tower is comparable to a steel building bay that would be found in a typical 15 to 20-story skyscraper or in warehouse construction. 40 tons of steel were used to fabricate the tower, which was the height of a 6-story building. The cross bracing was much stronger than that normally used in ordinary steel construction. The absence of the solid walls of a building gave the blast a much less effective surface to push against. The blast tore the tower from its foundations, twisted it, ripped it apart, and left it flat on the ground. The effects on the tower indicate that, at that distance, unshielded permanent steel and masonry buildings would have been destroyed. None of us had expected it to be damaged. Groves also included the impressions of his deputy, General Thomas F. Farrell, who was with Oppenheimer at the control shelter. Everyone in that room knew the awful potentialities of the thing that they thought was about to happen, reported Farrell, who wrote of the explosion's searing light and a roar which warned of doomsday, and described how, when it was over, Dr. Kistyakovsky threw his arms around Dr. Oppenheimer and embraced him with shouts of glee. Others were equally enthusiastic. All the pent-up emotions were released in those few minutes, and all seemed to sense immediately that the explosion had far exceeded the most optimistic expectations and wildest hopes of the scientists. All seemed to feel that they had been present at the birth of a new age. In his conclusion, Groves wrote, "We are all fully conscious that our real goal is still before us. The battle test is what counts." To read it all took Stimson nearly an hour. Whether Truman or Burns interrupted with questions or comments is unknown. But when Stimson stopped reading, Truman and Burns both looked immensely pleased. "The president in particular was tremendously pepped up," wrote Stimson. "He said it gave him an entirely new confidence, and he thanked me for having come to the conference and being present to help him this way." Indeed, all three men felt an overwhelming sense of relief.
that so much time and effort, that so vast an investment of money and resources had not been futile. It was not just that $2 billion had been spent, but that it was $2 billion that could have been used for the war effort in other ways. The thing worked. It could end the war. And there was the pride, too, that a task of such complexity and magnitude, so completely unprecedented, had been an American success. Clearly, Truman was fortified by the news. It is hard to imagine that he would not have been. That he and Burns felt their hand might be thus strengthened at the bargaining table with the Russians in time to come is also obvious and perfectly understandable. But by no means was this the primary consideration, as some would later contend. Truman went directly from the meeting to the Cecilienhof Palace, where, as the next session got underway, the change in him was pronounced. He was more sure of himself, more assertive. "It was apparent something had happened," wrote Robert Murphy, a political adviser to General Eisenhower. Churchill later told Stimson he could not imagine what had come over the president. When Stimson went to see the prime minister the next day to read him Groves's report, Churchill's response was more emphatic than Truman's by far.
"Stimson, what was gunpowder?" exclaimed Churchill. "What was electricity? Meaningless. This atomic bomb is the second coming in wrath."
In an exchange across the table, Stalin said the three governments should issue a statement announcing a renewal of diplomatic relations with the former German satellite nations of Romania, Bulgaria, and Finland. When Truman disagreed, Stalin said the questions would have to be postponed. "We will not recognize these governments until they are set up on a satisfactory basis," said Truman. Again, they addressed the thorny question of Poland. In vague language at Yalta, it had been agreed that Poland was to get new territory on the west from Germany to compensate for what Russia had taken from Poland on the east. At issue was Poland's western border and the fact that the Polish government of the moment, and the Red Army, had already taken over what had been a sizable part of Germany. Truman thought such matters should be settled at the peace conference. It had been agreed, he said, that the Germany of 1937 was to be the starting point. "We decided on our zones. We moved our troops to the zones assigned to us. Now another occupying government has been assigned a zone without consultation with us. I am very friendly to Poland and sympathetic with what Russia proposes regarding the western frontier, but I do not want to do it that way." In other words, the Russians could not arbitrarily dictate how things were to be, and there would be no progress on reparations or other matters concerning Germany until this was understood. "I am concerned that a piece of Germany, a valuable piece, has been cut off. This must be deemed a part of Germany in considering reparations and in the feeding of Germany. The Poles have no right to seize this territory now and take it out of the peace settlement. Are we going to maintain occupied zones until the peace, or are we going to give Germany away piecemeal?" He was not contentious, only unequivocal. Churchill was delighted. Eden thought it the president's best day thus far, as did Leahy, though Leahy was certain the Russians had no intention of changing their course in Eastern Europe, regardless of what was said. Poland was a Soviet fait accompli, thought Leahy, and there was little the United States or Britain could do about it, short of going to war with the Russians, which was unthinkable. There was no trace of tension at the lavish party given by Stalin that night in honor of his Western allies. Truman had the best time of his entire stay at Potsdam. "Stalin's affair was a wow," he reported to his mother and sister. "Started with caviar and vodka, and wound up with watermelon and champagne, with smoked fish, fresh fish, venison, chicken, duck, and all sorts of vegetables in between. There was a toast every 5 minutes until at least 25 had been drunk. I ate very little and drank less, but it was a colorful and enjoyable occasion. When I had Stalin and Churchill here for dinner, I think I told you that a young sergeant named List from Philadelphia played the piano, and a boy from the Metropolitan Orchestra played the violin. They are the best we have, and they are very good. Stalin sent to Moscow and brought his 2 best pianists and 2 feminine violinists. They were excellent. Played Chopin, Liszt, Tchaikovsky, and all the rest. I congratulated him and them on their ability. They had dirty faces, though, and the gals were rather fat. Anyway, it was a nice dinner. To Bess, he reported that the evening had meant more progress in his relations with Stalin, and said again that he already had what he wanted, the promise of Russian support against Japan. Possibly Stalin may also have told him that 1 million Russian troops were now massed along the Manchurian border. He talked to me confidently at the dinner, and I believe things will be all right in most instances. Some things we won't and can't agree on. But I already have what I came for. Churchill, who cared little for music, told Truman he was bored to tears and going home. Truman said he would stay until the party was over. So Churchill stalked off to a corner where, with Leahy for another half hour until the music ended, he glowered, growled, and grumbled, as a delighted Truman would tell the story. 2 nights later, when it was his turn as host, Churchill had his revenge. He summoned a Royal Air Force band and instructed them to play as loud as possible all through dinner and afterward. Possibly the hardest judge of character in the whole American delegation was Admiral Ernest J. King, Chief of Naval Operations, whose strong mind and long experience had made him invaluable to Roosevelt. A poised, impressive-looking man, King had played a part in every major conference of the war, beginning with the shipboard meeting of Roosevelt and Churchill that produced the Atlantic Charter in the summer of 1941. On the night of Stalin's dinner at Potsdam, King had leaned over to whisper to Lord Moran. "Watch the president," he said. "This is all new to him, but he can take it. He is a more typical American than Roosevelt, and he will do a good job, not only for the United States, but for the whole world." Bolin, who had been at Roosevelt's side as interpreter at Tehran and Yalta, later described his amazement at Truman's natural self-possession, his ease with people, the way he moved through the conference with the poise of a leader of much greater experience. The president's physical well-being impressed nearly everyone. "Churchill and Stalin were given to late hours, while I was an early riser," Truman would later comment. "This made my days extra long." Yet he seemed above fatigue. He was out of bed and dressed by 5:30 or 6 o'clock regularly every morning, and needed no alarm clock or anyone to wake him. Subordinates found him invariably cheerful and positive. He was never known to make a rude or inconsiderate remark, or to berate anyone, or to appear the least out of sorts, no matter how much stress he was under. From first to last, he remained entirely himself. "There was no pretense whatever about him," recalled the naval aide, Lieutenant Rigdon, who was charged with keeping the daily log. "The great thing about the president," said Floyd Boring, one of the Secret Service men, "was that he never got swaggly. He never came on as being superior. He could talk to anyone. He could talk to the lowest peasant. He could talk to the King of England. And that was, I think, his secret. He never got swell-headed. Never got, you know, swaggly." In Berlin, the black market, trade in cigarettes, watches, whiskey, and prostitution were rampant. One evening at the end of an arduous session at the palace, a young Army public relations officer, seeing that Truman was about to leave alone in his car, stuck his head in the window and asked if he might hitch a ride. Truman told him to get in, and Floyd Boring, who was driving, could not help overhearing the conversation as they headed off. The officer said that if there was anything the president wanted, anything at all he needed, he had only to say the word. Anything, you know, like women. "Listen, son, I married my sweetheart," Truman said. "She doesn't run around on me, and I don't run around on her. I want that understood. Don't ever mention that kind of stuff to me again."
By the time we were home, Boring remembered, he got out of the car and never even said goodbye to that guy.
Another member of the delegation, a State Department official named Emilio Collado, would recall a scene at No. 2 Kaiserstrasse on the afternoon of Saturday the 21st. Arriving with a document for the president to sign, Collado was shown into a large empty room overlooking the lake, where he saw seated at a grand piano an alert small man in shirt sleeves with a drink on the corner of the piano. Gathered beside him, singing, were Burns and Leahy, both with their jackets off. "I thought it was nice," Collado said years later. "The president played the piano quite well, in a rather old-time ragtime manner, and they were having a fine time. They weren't drunk or anything like that. They each had a drink. I have often thought of that picture. The five-star admiral, the secretary of state, and the president, together on a Saturday afternoon, having a little music." The fact of the matter is that Harry Truman was a very human man. They were having a little quiet relaxation. They had had their lunch. They had a little free time, and there they were. I can't say that the singing was very high quality, but the piano playing was quite good.
Section 4. With the start of his second week at Potsdam, Truman knew that decisions on the bomb could wait no longer. At 10 o'clock Sunday morning, July 22nd, he attended Protestant services led by a chaplain from the 2nd Armored Division. Then later in the morning he went to a Catholic Mass conducted by his old friend Father Curtis Tiernan, the chaplain of Battery D, who was serving as chief of Army chaplains in Europe and had been flown to Berlin at Truman's request. "I'm going to Mass at 11:30, presided over by him," Truman wrote to Bess at mid-morning. "I've already been to a Protestant service, so I guess I should stand in good with the Almighty for the coming week, and my, how I'll need it." Stimson had appeared at No. 2 Kaiserstrasse shortly after breakfast, with messages from Washington saying all was about ready for the final operation, and that a decision on the target cities was needed. Stimson wanted Kyoto removed from the list, and having heard the reasons, Truman agreed. Kyoto would be spared. "Although it was a target of considerable military importance," Stimson would write, "it had been the capital of Japan and was a shrine of Japanese art and culture." First on the list of approved targets was Hiroshima, southern headquarters and depot for Japan's homeland army. Early on Monday, Stimson came again to Truman's second-floor office. A warning message to Japan, an ultimatum, was nearly ready, the document to be known as the Potsdam Declaration. Stimson thought it unwise at this point to insist on unconditional surrender, a term the Japanese would take to mean they could not keep their emperor. He urged a revision to read that the Allies would prosecute the war against Japan until she ceases to resist. But Burns had vehemently opposed any such change. Unconditional surrender was an objective too long established, too often proclaimed. It had been too great a rallying cry from the time of Pearl Harbor to abandon now, Burns insisted. Truman had reaffirmed it as policy in his first speech to Congress on April 16th. It was what the Nazis had been made to accept, and its renunciation with the Japanese at this late date after so much bloodshed
The acceptance of anything less, with victory so near, would seem like appeasement. Politically, it would be disastrous, Burns was also sure. To most Americans, Hirohito was the villainous symbol of Japan's fanatical military clique. A Gallup poll in June had shown that a mere fraction of Americans, only 7%, thought he should be retained after the war even as a puppet, while a full third of the people thought he should be executed as a war criminal. Like others who had been advising Truman, Burns considered any negotiations with Japan over terms a waste of time, and felt that if Hirohito were to remain in place, then the war had been pointless. Though Truman listened carefully, Stimson failed to convince him otherwise. Tuesday, July 24th, was almost certainly the fateful day. At 9:20 a.m., Stimson again climbed the stairs to Truman's office, where he found the president seated behind the heavy carved desk, alone with his work. Stimson had brought another message. Washington, July 23rd, 1945. Top Secret. Operational Priority. War 36792. Secretary of War Eyes Only. Top Secret from Harrison. Operation may be possible any time from August 1st, depending on state of preparation of patient and condition of atmosphere. From point of view of patient only, some chance August 1st to 3rd. Good chance August 4th to 5th, and barring unexpected relapse, almost certain before August 10th. Truman said that was just what he wanted, Stimson wrote in his diary, that he was highly delighted. Later, Truman wrote of a consensus at Potsdam among Burns, Stimson, Leahy, Marshall, and General Arnold that the bomb should be used. He recalled that Marshall again stressed the number of lives that would be saved. I asked General Marshall what it would cost in lives to land on the Tokyo plain and other places in Japan. It was his opinion that such an invasion would cost at a minimum 250,000 American casualties. He himself reached his own conclusion only after long and careful thought, he wrote, adding, I did not like the weapon. Very possibly, there was no one clear-cut moment when he made up his mind or announced that he had. Most likely, he never seriously considered not using the bomb. Indeed, to have said no at this point and called everything off would have been so drastic a break with the whole history of the project, not to say the terrific momentum of events that summer, as to have been almost inconceivable. Some critics and historians in years to come would argue that Japan was already finished by this time, just as Eisenhower had said, and as several intelligence reports indicated. Japan's defeat, however, was not the issue. It was Japan's surrender that was so desperately wanted, since every day Japan did not surrender meant the killing continued. In theory, Japan had been defeated well before Truman became president. Studies by the Japanese themselves had determined a year and a half before, by January 1944, that Japan had lost the war. Yet, in the 3 months since Truman took office, American battle casualties in the Pacific were nearly half the total from 3 years of war in the Pacific. The nearer victory came, the heavier the price in blood. And whatever the projected toll in American lives in an invasion, it was too high if it could be avoided. We had only too abundant evidence in those days that surrender was excluded from the Japanese ethos, remembered a captain in military intelligence, Charlton Ogburn, Jr. Thousands of our Marines and soldiers had died rooting Japanese from their foxholes and bunkers when they were perfectly aware that their situation was hopeless. During the whole war, not a single Japanese unit had surrendered. While intelligence reports indicated that Japan was beaten, they also forecast that the Japanese would hold out for months longer, meanwhile issuing intermittent peace feelers, both to bring the war to what they would regard as an acceptable conclusion, and to weaken the determination of the United States to fight to the bitter end. The basic policy of the present Japanese government, said a Combined Intelligence Committee report of July 8, 1945, is to fight as long and as desperately as possible in the hope of avoiding complete defeat and of acquiring a better bargaining position in a negotiated peace. Japanese leaders are now playing for time, in the hope that Allied war weariness, Allied disunity, or some miracle will present an opportunity to arrange a compromise peace. Nor, it must be stressed, was there ever anything hypothetical about preparations for the invasion on both sides, a point sometimes overlooked in later years. Truman had earlier authorized the chiefs of staff to move more than 1 million troops for a final attack on Japan. 30 divisions were on the way to the Pacific from the European theater, from one end of the world to the other, something never done before. Supplies in tremendous quantity were piling up on Saipan. Japan had some 2.5 million regular troops on the home islands, but every male between the ages of 15 and 60, every female from 17 to 45, was being conscripted and armed with everything from ancient brass cannon to bamboo spears, taught to strap explosives to their bodies and throw themselves under advancing tanks. One woman would remember being given a carpenter's awl and instructed that killing just one American would do. "You must aim at the abdomen," she was told. "Understand? The abdomen." The general in charge of defense plans told other senior officers, "By pouring 20 divisions into the battle within 2 weeks of the enemy's landing, we will annihilate him entirely and ensure a Japanese victory." Thousands of planes were ready to serve as kamikazes. To no one with the American and Allied forces in the Pacific did it look as though the Japanese were about to quit. On July 15th, the New York Times reported that 25 warfront correspondents from the United States and Australia had compared notes, and their guess was the war would not end for nearly a year, not until June 1946. At the Pentagon, a long-remembered poster in the halls showed the face of a combat-hardened infantryman looking with grim determination at a map of the Japanese home islands, while across the top in bold letters was slashed the single word, "Next." There was no talk at the Pentagon of an early end to the war. The great concern was the likelihood of huge Japanese forces in China and Southeast Asia fighting on even if the government in Tokyo were to give up. Truman foresaw unprecedented carnage in any attempted invasion. "It occurred to me," he would remark a few months later, "that 250,000 of the flower of our young manhood were worth a couple of Japanese cities, and I still think they were and are." But whether 250,000 or 20,000 casualties would result was not the issue at the moment. Not if the shock effect of a single devastating blow or two could stop the war, and particularly when devastating blows in the form of B-29 raids had become the standard, almost daily routine. "Today's prime fact is war," Henry Stimson had said at the start of one interim committee meeting. The Japanese were the despised enemy, perpetrators of the treacherous attack on Pearl Harbor, and then in the midst of peace talks, perpetrators of the bombing of Manila and the Bataan Death March. They were the murderers of American prisoners of war, the fanatics who ordered the seemingly insane kamikaze attacks. The details of the Bataan Death March had become known only in February and enraged the country. Other atrocities included the Palawan Massacre, during which Japanese soldiers on the Philippine island of Palawan lured 140 American prisoners of war into air raid trenches, then doused them with gasoline and burned them alive. A few days after the German surrender in May, the papers had carried a photograph of a blindfolded prisoner of war, an American flyer down on his knees, his hands tied behind his back, about to be beheaded by a Japanese officer swinging a sword. At Potsdam, as Bohlen was to write, the spirit of mercy was not throbbing in the breast of any Allied official, either for the Germans or the Japanese. And how could a president, or the others charged with responsibility for the decision, answer to the American people if, when the war was over, after the bloodbath of an invasion of Japan, it became known that a weapon sufficient to end the war had been available by midsummer and was not used? Had the bomb been ready in March and deployed by Roosevelt, had it shocked Japan into surrender then, it would have already saved nearly 50,000 American lives lost in the Pacific in the time since, not to say a vastly larger number of Japanese lives. Nor had anyone ever doubted that Roosevelt would use it. At no time from 1941 to 1945 did I ever hear it suggested by the president or by any other responsible member of the government that atomic energy should not be used in the war, wrote Stimson. All of us, of course, understood the terrible responsibility involved. President Roosevelt particularly spoke to me many times of his own awareness of the catastrophic potentialities of our work. But we were at war. Leahy later said, I know FDR would have used it in a minute to prove that he hadn't wasted $2 billion. I'll say that we'll end the war a year sooner now, Truman had told Bess in a letter the week before, speaking of Stalin's agreement to come in against Japan. And think of the kids who won't be killed. That's the important thing. To him, it was always the important thing. An invasion of Japan would be work for ground troops, dirty, god-awful business for infantry and artillery, as he knew from experience. For unlike Roosevelt or Woodrow Wilson, or any commander-in-chief since the advent of modern war, Truman had been in combat with ground troops. At the Argonne, seeing a German battery pull into position on the left flank beyond his assigned sector, he had ordered his battery to open fire because his action would save lives, even though he could face a court-martial. It is just the same as artillery on our side, he would say later of the bomb, which would strike many people as appallingly insensitive and simplistic. But he was speaking from the experience of war. Once, when presiding judge of Jackson County, he had, by his own private confession, allowed a crooked contractor to steal $10,000 in order to forestall the stealing of 10 times the amount. He had permitted evil in order to prevent a larger evil, and saw no other choice. Had he done right, had he done wrong, he had asked, writing alone late at night in the Pickwick Hotel. You judge it. I can't. Conceivably, as many would later argue, the Japanese might have surrendered before November and the scheduled invasion. Conceivably, they could have been strangled by naval blockade, forced to surrender by continued firebombing with its dreadful toll, as some strategists were saying at the time. Possibly the single sticking point was, after all, the Allied demand for unconditional surrender. But no one close to Truman was telling him not to use the new weapon. General Marshall fully expected the Japanese to fight on even if the bomb were dropped and proved as effective as the scientists predicted. Marshall saw the bomb more as a way to make the invasion less costly. That it might make the invasion unnecessary was too much to expect. We knew the Japanese were determined and fanatical, and we would have to exterminate them man by man, he would later tell David Lilienthal. So we thought the bomb would be a wonderful weapon as a protection and preparation for landings. Marshall had been so appalled by American casualties at Iwo Jima that he had favored using poison gas at Okinawa. A petition drawn up by Leo Szilard, urging on grounds of morality that Japan be warned in advance, had been signed by 70 scientists, but was not delivered to Washington until after Truman had left for Potsdam. Truman never saw it. But neither did he see the counter-opinions voiced by those scientists urging that the bomb be used, and on grounds of morality. Are not the men of the fighting forces who are risking their lives for the nation entitled to the weapons which have been designed? Said one petition. In short, are we to go on shedding American blood when we have available means to a steady victory? No. If we can save even a handful of American lives, then let us use this weapon. Now. It is hard to imagine anything more conclusive than the devastation of all the eastern coastal cities of Japan by firebombs, wrote another scientist. A more fiendish hell than the inferno of blazing Tokyo is beyond the pale of conception. Then, why do we attempt to draw the line of morality here, when it is a question of degree, not a question of kind? In a poll of 150 scientists at the Metallurgical Laboratory at Chicago, 87% voted for military use of the weapon if other means failed to bring surrender. Arthur Compton was asked for his opinion. What a question to answer, he later wrote. Having been in the very midst of these discussions, it seemed to me that a firm negative stand on my part might still prevent an atomic attack on Japan. Thoughts of my pacifist Mennonite ancestors flashed through my mind. I knew all too well the destruction and human agony the bombs would cause. I knew the danger they held in the hands of some future tyrant. These facts I had been living with for 4 years. But I wanted the war to end. I wanted life to become normal again. I hoped that by use of the bombs, many fine young men I knew might be released at once from the demands of war and thus be given a chance to live and not to die. Churchill was to write of the decision that was no decision. And in retrospect, this seems to have been the case. The historic fact remains and must be judged in the after time, Churchill wrote, that the decision whether or not to use the atomic bomb to compel the surrender of Japan was never an issue. There was unanimous, automatic, unquestioned agreement around our table, nor did I ever hear the slightest suggestion that we should do otherwise. Truman made no decision because there was no decision to be made, recalled George Elsie, remembering the atmosphere of the moment. He could no more have stopped it than a train moving down a track. It's all well and good to come along later and say the bomb was a horrible thing. The whole goddamn war was a horrible thing. For his part, Truman stated later, "The final decision of where and when to use the atomic bomb was up to me. Let there be no mistake about it. I regarded the bomb as a military weapon and never had any doubt that it should be used. The top military advisers to the president recommended its use, and when I talked to Churchill, he unhesitatingly told me that he favored the use of the atomic bomb if it might aid to end the war." Though nothing was recorded on paper, The critical moment appears to have occurred at No. 2 Kaiserstrasse later in the morning of Tuesday, July 24th, when, at 11:30, the combined American and British chiefs of staff convened with Truman and Churchill in the dining room. This was the one time when Truman, Churchill, and their military advisors were all around a table, in Churchill's phrase. From this point, it was settled. Barring some unforeseen development, the bomb would be used within a few weeks. Truman later told Arthur Compton that the day of the decision was the same day he informed Stalin, and that occurred late the afternoon of the 24th. It happened at the end of a particularly contentious session at the Cecilienhof Palace. The meeting was just breaking up when Truman rose from his chair and alone walked slowly around the table to where Stalin stood with his interpreter. "I casually mentioned to Stalin that we had a new weapon of unusual destructive force," Truman remembered. "All he said was that he was glad to hear it and hoped we would make good use of it against the Japanese." Truman did not specify what kind of weapon it was. He did not use the words atomic bomb, or say anything about sharing scientific secrets. Stalin seemed neither surprised nor the least curious. He did not ask the nature of the weapon or how it was made or why he hadn't been told before this. He did not suggest that Soviet scientists be informed or permitted to examine it. He did not, in fact, appear at all interested. To Bolin, who was watching closely from across the room, Stalin's response seemed so altogether offhand that Bolin wondered whether the president had made himself clear. "If he had had the slightest idea of the revolution in world affairs which was in progress, his reactions would have been obvious," wrote Churchill, who had kept his eye on Stalin's face. Burns, too, was certain Stalin had not grasped the importance of the discovery, and would soon be asking for more details. But this Stalin never did. He never mentioned the subject again for the remainder of the conference. The fact was, Stalin already knew more than any of the Americans or British imagined. Soviet nuclear research had begun in 1942, and as would be learned later, a German-born physicist at Los Alamos, a naturalized British citizen named Klaus Fuchs, had been supplying the Russians with atomic secrets for some time, information that in Moscow was judged extremely excellent and very valuable. Stalin had understood perfectly what Truman said. Later, in the privacy of their Babelsberg quarters, according to Marshal Georgi Zhukov, Stalin instructed Molotov to tell Kurchatov of the Soviet atomic project to hurry up the work. Also, according to the Russian historian Dmitry Volkogonov, Stalin went even further that evening when he cabled Lavrenty Beria, who had overall supervision of the project, to put on the pressure. In years to come, Truman often said that having made his decision about the bomb, he went to bed and slept soundly. He would be pictured retiring for the night at the White House, his mind clear that he had done the right thing. But in the strange nightmare house at Babelsberg, in the unremitting heat of the German summer, he was sleeping rather poorly, and in considerably more turmoil than his later claims ever suggested. No one who played a part in the development of the bomb or in our decision to use it felt happy about it, recalled Jimmy Burns, who was quartered downstairs. "We have discovered the most terrible bomb in the history of the world," Truman wrote in his diary on Wednesday, July 25th, the day the general military order was issued to the Air Force to proceed with the plan. And terrible was the word he would keep coming back to. He wondered if the bomb might be the fire of destruction prophesied in the Bible. as if to convince himself, he wrote of how it would be used on military targets only, which he knew to be only partly true. "This weapon is to be used against Japan between now and August 10th. I have told the Secretary of War, Mr. Stimson, to use it so that military objectives and soldiers and sailors are the target and not women and children. Even if the Japs are savages, ruthless, merciless, and fanatic, we, as the leader of the world for the common welfare, cannot drop this terrible bomb on the old capital, Kyoto, or the new, Tokyo, where the imperial palace had been spared thus far. He and I are in accord. The target will be a purely military one, and we will issue a warning statement asking the Japs to surrender and save lives. I'm sure they will not do that, but we will have given them a chance. It is certainly a good thing for the world that Hitler's crowd or Stalin's did not discover this atomic bomb. It seems to be the most terrible thing ever discovered, but it can be made useful." Whether this final thought, that it could be made useful, was his irrepressible native optimism and faith in progress coming to the fore, or yet another way of trying to convince himself, or both of these, or merely means useful to end the war, is open to question. Section 5. It would be the thesis of some historians that the atomic bomb figured importantly at Potsdam as Truman's way of putting pressure on the Russians. But except for his private show of bolstered confidence after hearing Groves's report, Truman neither said nor did anything of consequence to support this theory, and the whole idea would be vigorously denied by those who were present and witness to events. Once, sometime before the test at Alamogordo, Truman reportedly remarked to some of his aides that if the bomb worked, he would certainly have the hammer on those boys. But whether by this he meant the Russians or the Japanese was unclear. And there was no intimation ever of a hammer, no flaunting of power in his dealings with Stalin. The idea of using the bomb as a form of pressure on the Russians never entered the discussions at Potsdam, wrote Harriman. That wasn't the president's mood at all. The mood was to treat Stalin as an ally, a difficult ally, admittedly, in the hope that he would behave like one. At the conference session preceding Truman's disclosure to Stalin of the bomb secret, the Generalissimo had been as difficult as at any time thus far. Truman was firm in his positions, yet never belligerent or reproachful. He had no intention to make reflection upon Stalin or his government, he stressed. The sharp exchanges were between Churchill and Stalin, Churchill having at last recovered much of his old spirit. The topic on the agenda was the admission to the United Nations of Italy and the Balkan states formerly allied with Germany, the so-called satellite countries. It was the American and British position that Italy should be admitted, but that Romania, Bulgaria, and Hungary, all now firmly in Russian control, should not, until democratic governments were established. Stalin observed that since no democratic elections had been held in Italy either, he failed to understand this benevolent attitude toward Italy. The difference, said Truman, was that everyone had free access to Italy, while for the Western Allies there was no free access to the Balkan countries. It was a point that Burns, too, had been making in meetings of the foreign ministers. "We are asking for the reorganization of the satellite governments along democratic lines as agreed upon at Yalta," Truman said. Stalin's calm rejoinder was very simple. "If a government is not fascist, a government is democratic," he said. Churchill pointed out that Italy was an open society with a free press. where diplomatic missions could go freely about their business. At Bucharest, by contrast, the British mission was penned up as if under arrest. An iron fence had descended, said Churchill darkly.
All fairy tales, exclaimed Stalin. Statesmen may call one another's statements fairy tales if they wish, answered Churchill.
As Bolin was to write, no moment at the conference so revealed the gulf between the Soviet Union and the Western Allies. Taking Churchill's side, Truman said that difficulties encountered by the American missions in Romania and Bulgaria had also been cause for concern. That night, Churchill would go on at length to Lord Moran about his admiration for Truman's plain, direct way with Stalin.
The president is not going to be content to feed out of anyone's hand. He intends to get to the bottom of things, Churchill would say, rubbing his eyes as if to remind himself he was not dreaming. If only this had happened at Yalta.
But then, after a pause, he added sadly,
It is too late now.
Truman tried to salvage the afternoon with progress in another direction. The previous day, he had formally introduced his plan to internationalize the world's inland waterways, rivers, and canals, including the Danube, the Rhine, the Dardanelles, the Kiel Canal, the Suez and Panama Canals. All nations, including Russia, were to have access to all the seas of the world. I do not want to fight another war in 20 years because of a quarrel on the Danube, he had said. We want a prosperous, self-supporting Europe. A bankrupt Europe is of no advantage to any country or to the peace of the world. Stalin had said he wanted time to consider. So now Truman brought it up again, hoping for the best. Clearly, it was important to him. Stalin cut him off, declaring,
The question is not ripe for discussion.
On Wednesday, July 25th, the conference was put on hold. Churchill was about to leave for London to face the final results of the general election. Anthony Eden and others of the British delegation were also to depart, as well as Churchill's opponent in the election, the quiet, mousy Clement Attlee, who dressed in a three-piece suit despite the summer heat, and who seemed as convinced as everyone else that Churchill was certain to win and would return in a matter of days. Churchill, privately, was full of foreboding. He had had a dream in which he saw himself lying dead beneath a white sheet in an empty room. He knew who it was, he told Moran, because he recognized the protruding feet.
What a pity,
Stalin said at the close of that morning's session, when Churchill announced he had no more to say. Outside, afterward, by the front door of the palace, Churchill, Stalin, and Truman posed for a final portrait. Truman, looking very much the American politician, stood in the middle with crossed arms, shaking hands with both men at once, smiling first at one, then the other, as a battery of photographers and newsreel cameramen recorded the moment. Even Stalin broke into a grin. The next day from London came the stunning news that the Labour Party had won. Churchill was defeated. Clement Attlee was the new Prime Minister. Hardly anyone could believe it. But the Russians seemed most upset of all. How could this possibly be? Molotov kept demanding. How could they not have known the outcome in advance? Stalin postponed the conference for another few days and was seen by no one. First, Roosevelt, now Churchill, Truman noted privately. The old order was passing. Uneasily, he wondered what might happen if Stalin were suddenly to cash in and a power struggle convulsed the Soviet Union. It isn't customary for dictators to train leaders to follow them in power.
I've seen no one at this conference in the Russian lineup who can do the job.
His feelings about Churchill were mixed, as much as he liked him. It was too bad about Churchill, he wrote to his mother and sister, but then he added that it may turn out to be all right for the world, suggesting that this way, without Churchill around, he might make better progress with Stalin. That same day, July 26th, at the island of Tinian in the Pacific, the cruiser Indianapolis delivered the U-235 portion of an atomic bomb nicknamed Little Boy. That evening, Burns and Truman decided to release the Potsdam Declaration. Phrased as a joint statement by Truman, Attlee, and Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek, it assured the Japanese people humane treatment. They would not be enslaved as a race or destroyed as a nation. Once freedom of speech and religion were established, once Japan's war-making power had been eliminated and a responsible, peacefully inclined government freely elected, occupation forces would be withdrawn. The words unconditional surrender appeared only once in the final paragraph, and then specified only the unconditional surrender of the armed forces, not the Japanese nation. The alternative was prompt and utter destruction. The fate of Emperor Hirohito was left ambiguous. He was not mentioned. Nor was there any explanation of what form the prompt and utter destruction might take. The declaration was picked up by Japanese radio monitors at 6 in the morning, July 27th, Tokyo time, and Prime Minister Kotaro Suzuki and the cabinet went into an all-day meeting. Meanwhile, over Tokyo and 10 other Japanese cities, American planes were dropping millions of leaflets with a printed translation of the declaration. Suzuki's decision was to ignore the matter. The declaration, he said at a press conference, was nothing but a rehash of old proposals and, as such, beneath contempt. He would kill it with silence, he said. Clement Attlee and his new foreign minister, Ernest Bevin, arrived at Babelsberg the night of Saturday the 28th, and Truman was impressed with neither. A couple of sourpusses, he decided. Bevin looked as though he weighed 250 pounds. Mr. Attlee is not so keen as old fat Winston, and Mr. Bevin looks rather rotund to be a foreign minister, Truman wrote to Margaret. Seems Bevin is sort of the John L. Lewis type. Eden was a perfect striped pants boy. I wasn't fond of Eden. He is a much overrated man. And he didn't play fair with his boss. I did like old Churchill. He was as windy as Longer, Senator William Longer of North Dakota. But he knew his English language, and after he'd talked half an hour, there'd be at least one gem of a sentence and two thoughts, maybe, which could have been expressed in 4 minutes. But if we ever got him on record, which was seldom, he stayed put. Anyway, he is a likable person, and these other two are sourpusses. Attlee is an Oxford graduate and talks with that deep-throated, swallowing enunciation same as Eden does. But I understand him reasonably well. Bevin is a tough guy. He doesn't know, of course, that your dad has been dealing with that sort all his life, from building trades to coal mines. So he won't be new. We shall see what we shall see, he wrote to Bess. Secretary of the Navy, Forrestal, who had only just arrived, found Truman in an optimistic mood concerning the Russians, in contrast to others in the delegation. Harriman was very gloomy. Burns was most anxious to get the Japanese affair over with before the Russians got in. All messages to the president from the War Department came into Babelsberg a half block down the street from No. 2 Kaiserstrasse at the Army Message Center, where they were immediately decoded. From there, they were taken to No. 2 Kaiserstrasse, to the officers on duty in the map room, who would give them to the president. Late on Monday, July 30th, another urgent top-secret cable to Truman was received and decoded, but held for delivery until morning in order not to disturb the president's rest. It was from Harrison in Washington. The time schedule on Groves's project is progressing so rapidly that it is now essential that statement for release by you be available not later than Wednesday, August 1st. The time had come for Truman to give the final go-ahead for the bomb. This was the moment, the decision only he could make. The message was delivered at 7:48 a.m. Berlin time, Tuesday, July 31st. Writing large and clear with a lead pencil on the back of the pink message, Truman gave his answer, which he handed to Lieutenant Elsey for transmission. Suggestion approved. Release when ready, but not sooner than August 2nd. Elsey, a lanky, earnest, good-looking young officer, a Princeton graduate who had a master's degree in history from Harvard, would not remember feeling that he was witness to one of history's momentous turning points. "Everything seemed momentous in those days at Potsdam," Elsey would recall. What impressed him was that Truman didn't want anything happening until he got away from Stalin, away from Potsdam. All efforts now were to wind things up by August 2nd. Stimson was already back at the Pentagon. Marshall was to leave later that day. The Potsdam Conference should have been a time of celebration. It should have been the most harmonious, most hopeful of the Big Three conferences, a watershed in history, marking the start of a new era of good feeling among the Allied powers now that the common foe, the detested Nazi, was destroyed. Such, at least, was the promise of Potsdam. But it wasn't that way. Nor, in practicality, had there ever been much chance it would be. At lunch, the first day they met, Stalin had told Truman he wanted to cooperate with the United States in peace as in war. But in peace, he said, that would be more difficult. It was what they all knew. And the underlying tensions felt at the beginning remained to the end. Truman had kept insisting on results, not talk. Something in the bag at the end of every day, as Churchill observed. It was why he was there, Truman would say. And as impatient as he grew, he seems to have felt right to the end that he could succeed. "We have accomplished a very great deal in spite of all the talk, so you see we have not wasted time," he wrote to Bess just before Churchill departed. He wanted the future of Germany settled satisfactorily. Germany was the key, the overriding question. He wanted free elections in Poland, Eastern Europe, and the Balkans. He wanted Russia to join in the assault on Japan as soon as possible. But only on this last item could he feel he had succeeded. For the rest, he faced ambiguity, delays, and frustration, Stalin having no wish to accept any agreement that threatened the control he already had, wherever the Red Army stood. Try as he might, Truman could make little or no progress with Stalin. Could Roosevelt have done better? It was a question Truman must have asked himself many times. Chip Bolin thought Roosevelt would have been less successful, since with his personal interest in earlier agreements with Stalin, Roosevelt would have acted more angrily than Truman when faced with Stalin's intransigence. To Bolin, Harriman, and others experienced in dealing with the Russians, Truman had acquitted himself well. "He was never defeated or made to look foolish or uninformed in debate," Bolin would write. And since neither Stalin nor Molotov ever tried any tricks or subtleties but only held stubbornly to their own line, the president's inexperience in diplomacy did not greatly matter after all. There was never any room for maneuver. "Pray for me and keep your fingers crossed, too," he wrote to Bess as the final week began. "We are at an impasse on Poland and its western boundary and on reparations," he wrote in his diary. "Russia and Poland have agreed on the Oder and West Nysa to the Czechoslovakian border without so much as a by your leave. I don't like it." But the Red Army had pushed to the Oder River and the western Nysa River, and so those rivers were agreed to as Poland's western frontier. Further, Poland was given the southern portion of East Prussia, including the port of Danzig, while the Soviet Union was granted the northern portion. As for free elections in Poland, it was agreed only that they should be held as soon as possible, which in reality meant the Polish issue remained unresolved. The future of Germany's former allies in the war, Italy, Bulgaria, Finland, Hungary, and Romania, was postponed, left to the Council of Foreign Ministers to resolve at some unspecified time in the future. Germany, already portioned off into four zones of military occupation, American, British, Russian, and French, was in effect divided down the middle between East and West. A complete demilitarization of the German state was agreed to. There was never an argument on that. Nazi war criminals were to be brought to justice. And there was no argument here either, not even over the place where the war crimes tribunal would sit. Nuremberg was the decision. And by a complicated formula for reparations, the Soviet Union got the lion's share, mainly in capital equipment, in view of the fact that the Soviet Union had suffered the greatest loss of life and property. In some instances, Stalin did not get what he wanted. Soviet trusteeship over Italy's former colonies in Africa, a naval base on the Bosporus, four-power control over Germany's industrial Ruhr Valley. But it was the Western leaders who made the big concessions, because they had little choice. Russian occupation of Eastern Europe was indeed a fait accompli, as Leahy said, and because they hoped to achieve harmony with Stalin. It was never possible to get all you wanted in such situations, Truman would explain to the American people, trying to put a good face on the situation. It is a question of give and take, of being willing to meet your neighbor halfway. To such experienced Soviet specialists as Harriman and George Kanam, it was foolishness in the extreme to imagine the Russians ever keeping faith with such words as democratic and justice, or to see the arrangement agreed to for Germany as anything other than unreal and unworkable. Kanan, who was not present at Potsdam, would later despair over Truman's naivete. Harriman, who was present throughout, found himself so shut out of serious discussions by Burns that he decided it was time for him to resign. Truman's waterways proposal got nowhere. On the next to final day of the conference, August 1st, he made one last try, asking only that it at least be mentioned in the final communique. Attlee said this was agreeable with him, but again, Stalin refused. Truman pointed out that the proposal had been discussed and that he was pressing only this one issue. "Marshal Stalin, I have accepted a number of compromises during this conference to confirm with your views," he said, "and I make a personal request now that you yield on this point." Stalin broke in even before his interpreter had finished with the president's statement. "Nyet," said Stalin. Then, with emphasis, and in English for the first time, he repeated, "No, I say no." It was an embarrassing, difficult moment. Truman turned red. "I cannot understand that man," he was heard to say. He turned to Burns. "Jimmy, do you realize we have been here 17 whole days? Why, in 17 days you can decide anything." In a letter to his mother, Truman called the Russians the most pig-headed people he had ever encountered. He knew them now to be relentless bargainers, forever pressing for every advantage for themselves, as he later said. And in his diary he left no doubt that he understood the reality of the Stalin regime. "It was police government pure and simple," he wrote. "A few top hands just take clubs, pistols, and concentration camps and rule the people on the lower levels." Later, he would tell John Snyder of an unsettling exchange with Stalin about the Katyn Forest massacre of 1940. When Truman asked what had happened to the Polish officers, Stalin answered coldly, "They went away." Still? Still? Truman liked him. "I like Stalin. He is straightforward," he wrote to Bess near the wind-up of the conference. Stalin could be depended upon to keep his word, he would later tell his White House staff. "The president," wrote Eben Ayers, "seemed to have been favorably impressed with him and to like him." "Stalin was a fine man who wanted to do the right thing," Truman would tell Henry Wallace. Furthermore, Truman was pretty sure Stalin liked him. To Jonathan Daniels, Truman would say he had been reminded of Tom Pendergast. "Stalin is as near like Tom Pendergast as any man I know." Not for a long time, not for a dozen years, would Truman concede that he had been naive at Potsdam. An innocent idealist, in his words, and refer to Stalin as the unconscionable Russian dictator. Yet even then he added, "And I liked the little son of a bitch." As Truman would later tell the American people, no secret agreements or commitments were made at Potsdam other than military arrangements. However, one secret agreement concerning military operations in Southeast Asia was to have far-reaching consequences. He, Churchill, and their combined chiefs of staff decided that Vietnam, or Indochina, would, for operational purposes, be divided, with China in charge north of the 16th parallel and British forces in the southern half, leaving little chance for the unification or independence of Vietnam and ample opportunity for the return of the French. Truman so informed the American ambassador in China, Patrick J. Hurley, by secret cable the last day of the conference, August 1st. At the time, given the other decisions he faced, both military and political, it did not seem overly important. The 13th and concluding session at the Cecilienhof Palace that evening was devoted almost exclusively to the wording of the final communique, and did not break up until past midnight. The struggle had come down to fine points. Molotov suggested an amendment in a paragraph that described Poland's western frontier as running from the Baltic through the town of Swinemünde. He wished to substitute the words "west of" for "through," Molotov said. "How far west?" asked Burns. "Immediately west," suggested Bevan. "Immediately west will satisfy us," Stalin affirmed. "That is all right," said Truman. "Agreed," said Attlee. Truman, in announcing that the business of the conference was ended, said in all sincerity that he hoped the next meeting would be in Washington.
"God willing," exclaimed Stalin, invoking the deity for the first and only time.
Then, in a conspicuously unusual tribute, Stalin commended Burns,
"who had worked harder, perhaps, than any of us, and worked very well."
There was much handshaking around the table and wishes for good health and safe journey. As it turned out, Truman and Stalin were never to meet again. Potsdam was their first and only big power conference. In his private assessment, Stalin later told Nikita Khrushchev, Truman was worthless. Section 6. Packing had been going on at No. 2 Kaiserstrasse for several days. Everyone, and especially the president, extremely ready to leave. At 6:45 Thursday morning, August 2nd, his motorcade was drawn up in the driveway. By 7:15, they were on their way to Gatow Airfield, where, at Truman's request, there were to be no ceremonies. At 8:05, the sacred cow was airborne, heading for Plymouth, England, to meet the USS Augusta. That will save 2 days on the ocean because it takes so long to get out of the English Channel when we leave from Antwerp, he explained in a letter to his mother and Mary Jane. He would be having lunch with the English king, he wrote. The lunch with King George VI took place on board the British battle cruiser HMS Renown, which, with the Augusta and Philadelphia, was anchored in Plymouth Roads. To his surprise, Truman found the king very pleasant, a good man, and extremely interested in hearing all about Potsdam. "We had a nice and appetizing lunch," Truman recorded. "Soup, fish, lamb chops, peas, potatoes, and ice cream with chocolate sauce. The king, myself, Lord Halifax, the British ambassador to Washington, a British admiral, Admiral Leahy, Alan Lascelles, the king's private secretary, the secretary of state, in that order around the table, talked of most everything and nothing. There was much formality, etc., in getting on and off the British ship." That afternoon, returning the call, the king came aboard the Augusta, inspected the guard, took a snort of Hagen Hague, as Truman happily recorded, and asked Truman for 3 of his autographs, 1 each for his daughters and the queen. 15 minutes after the king's departure, at 3:49, the Augusta was underway. The following day, August 3rd, his first full day at sea, Truman called the few members of the press who were on board into his cabin. Seated at a small table covered with green felt, a loose-leaf notebook open in front of him, he began telling them about the atomic bomb and its history. He spoke slowly, in measured tones. His emotions seemed divided. He was happy and thankful that we had a weapon in our hands which would speed the end of the war, remembered Merriman Smith of the United Press. But he was apprehensive over the development of such a monstrous weapon of destruction. How long the United States could remain the exclusive producer, Truman wasn't sure. The material in the notebook was his statement for the country, which had been prepared in advance before he left for Potsdam. The frustration of the reporters was extreme. "Here was the greatest news story since the invention of gunpowder," wrote Smith. "And what could we do about it? Nothing. Just sit and wait." On August 4th, according to the official log, the president was up and strolling the decks at 5 in the morning, looking completely rested from the strain of the long and tiring conference discussions. After an early breakfast, he spent the day studying conference reports and working on an address to the country. On Sunday, August 5th, he attended church services, then returned to his work. Merriman Smith remembered the day as extremely tense, and Truman looking worried. Smith and the other reporters tried to talk of other things. "The secret was so big and terrifying that we could not discuss it with each other." The ship, meantime, was boiling along at a full speed of 26.5 knots. On the morning of Monday, August 6th, the fourth day at sea, The president and several of his party spent time on deck enjoying the sun and listening to a concert by the ship's band. The ship had entered the Gulf Stream, south of Newfoundland. The sun was out, the weather considerably warmer. The crew had changed now to white uniforms that looked sparkling in the sunshine. At noon, the ship's position was latitude 39 degrees 55 minutes north, longitude 61 degrees 32 minutes west. The sea was calm. Shortly before noon, Truman and Burns had decided to have lunch with some of the crew below deck in the after mess. Truman was seated with six enlisted men, and just beginning his meal when Captain Graham, one of the map room officers, hurried in and handed him a map of Japan and a decoded message from the Secretary of War. Hiroshima had been bombed 4 hours earlier. Results clear-cut, successful in all respects. Visible effects greater than in any test, Truman read. On the map, Captain Graham had circled the city with a red pencil. Suddenly excited, Truman grabbed Graham by the hand and said, "This is the greatest thing in history," then told him to show the message to Burns, who was at another table. It was just after noon. Minutes later, a second message was brought in. Big bomb dropped on Hiroshima August 5th at 7:15 p.m. Washington time. First reports indicate complete success, which was even more conspicuous than earlier test. Truman jumped to his feet now and called to Burns, "It's time for us to get home." Like the scientists at Alamogordo at the moment of the first test, Truman was exuberant. Tapping on a glass with a fork, he called for the crew's attention. "Please keep your seats and listen for a moment. I have an announcement to make. We have just dropped a new bomb on Japan which has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. It has been an overwhelming success." With the crew cheering, he rushed out to spread the news. "He was not actually laughing," wrote Merriman Smith, "but there was a broad smile on his face. In the small dispatch which he waved at the men of the ship, he saw the quick end of the war written between the lines." At the officers' ward, telling the men to stay seated, he repeated what he had said in the mess, then added, "We won the gamble." He said he had never been happier about any announcement he had ever made. All this happened very fast, and as George Elsey was to recall, the president's response seemed in no way inappropriate. "We were all excited. Everyone was cheering." Within minutes, the ship's radio was carrying news bulletins from Washington about the bomb. Then came the broadcast of the president's message, the text of which had been released at the White House only moments before at 11 a.m. Washington time. 16 hours ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima. It is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. We are now prepared to obliterate more rapidly and completely every productive enterprise the Japanese have above ground in any city. We shall destroy their docks, their factories, and their communications. Let there be no mistake. We shall completely destroy Japan's power to make war. If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth. Not in this or any of the broadcasts was there mention of how much damage had been done at Hiroshima, since no details were yet known in Washington. Excitement. Feelings of relief swept the country, and especially among families with sons or husbands in the service. Surely, the war would be over any day. To the millions of men serving in the Pacific, and those in Europe preparing to be shipped to the Pacific, the news came as a joyous reprieve. One of them was the writer Paul Fussell, then a 21-year-old lieutenant with an infantry platoon in France, who was scheduled to take part in the invasion of Honshu, despite wounds in the leg and back so severe that he had been judged 40% disabled. "But even if my legs buckled whenever I jumped out of the back of the truck, my condition was held to be satisfactory for whatever lay ahead." After Hiroshima, he remembered, after the realization that we would not be obliged to run up the beaches near Tokyo assault firing while being mortared and shelled, for all the fake manliness of our facades, we cried with relief and joy. We were going to live. We were going to grow up to adulthood after all. Yet, even so, news of the bomb brought feelings of ambiguity and terror of a kind never before experienced by Americans. Children in households that had been untouched by the war would remember parents looking strangely apprehensive and wondering aloud what unimaginable new kind of horror had been unleashed. Could the poor world ever possibly be the same again? "Yesterday," wrote Hanson Baldwin in the New York Times on August 7th, "we clinched victory in the Pacific, but we sowed the whirlwind." Editorial speculation was extremely grave. "It is not impossible," wrote the Chicago Tribune, "that whole cities and all the people in them may be obliterated in a fraction of a second by a single bomb." "We are dealing with an invention that could overwhelm civilization," said the Kansas City Star. And in St. Louis, the Post-Dispatch warned that possibly science had signed the mammalian world's death warrant and deeded an earth in ruins to the ants. The Washington Post, in an editorial titled "The Haunted Wood," said that with Truman's revelations concerning the new bomb, it was as if all the worst imaginary horrors of science fiction had come true. The weather in Washington had turned abnormally cool for August, making ideal nights for sleeping. But, observed James Reston of the New York Times, thoughtful people were not sleeping so well. "Some of our scientists say that the area in Hiroshima will be uninhabitable for many years because the bomb explosion has made the ground radioactive and destructive of animal life," wrote Admiral Leahy, who had flown home ahead of the president. "The lethal possibilities of such atomic action in the future is frightening, and while we are the first to have it in our possession, there is a certainty that it will in the future be developed by potential enemies, and that it will probably be used against us." Robert Oppenheimer had predicted a death toll of perhaps 20,000. Early reports from Guam on August 8th indicated that 60% of Hiroshima had been leveled, and that the number of killed and injured might reach as high as 200,000. In time, it would be estimated that 80,000 people were killed instantly, and that another 50 to 60,000 died in the next several months. Of the total, perhaps 10,000 were Japanese soldiers. Many thousands more suffered from hideous thermal burns, from shock, and from radioactive poisoning. Later, also, there would be eyewitness accounts of people burned to a cinder while standing up, of birds igniting in midair, of women whose skin hung from them like a kimono, plunging, shrieking into rivers. "I do not know how many times I called begging that they cut off my burned arms and legs," a fifth-grade girl would remember. Anne O'Hare McCormick, who had described Truman, Churchill, and Stalin poking about the graveyard of Berlin, wrote now of the bomb as the ultimatum to end all ultimatums, because it was only a small sample of what might lie in store in laboratories where scientists and soldiers joined forces. No one as yet was blaming the scientists, or the soldiers, or the President of the United States. On the afternoon of August 7th, just before 5 p.m., the Augusta tied up at Norfolk. Truman left immediately by special train for Washington, and by the morning of the 8th, the country knew he was back at his desk. There was still no word from Japan, no appeal for mercy or sign of surrender. At the Pentagon, Stimson and Marshall worried privately that the bomb had failed to achieve the desired shock effect. On August 9th, the papers carried still more stupendous news. 1 million Russian troops had crossed into Manchuria. Russia was in the war against Japan. And a second atomic bomb had been dropped on the major Japanese seaport of Nagasaki. No high-level meeting had been held concerning this second bomb. Truman had made no additional decision. There was no order issued beyond the military directive for the first bomb, which had been sent on July 25th by Marshall's deputy, General Thomas T. Handy, to the responsible commander in the Pacific, General Carl A. Spatz of the 20th Air Force. Paragraph 2 of that directive had stipulated, "Additional bombs will be delivered on the above targets as soon as made ready by the project staff." A second bomb, a plutonium bomb nicknamed Fat Man, being ready, it was delivered from Tinian, and 2 days ahead of schedule in view of weather conditions. Later estimates were that 70,000 died at Nagasaki, where the damage would have been worse had the bombardier not been off target by 2 miles. For the second time in 4 days, Japan felt the stunning effect of the terrible weapon, reported the Los Angeles Times, which, like most papers, implied that the end was very near. On Capitol Hill, the typical reaction was, "It won't be long now." Senator Richard B. Russell, Jr. of Georgia, one of the most respected influential figures in Washington, sent a telegram to Truman saying there must be no let-up in the assault on the Japanese. "Let us carry the war to them until they beg us to accept unconditional surrender. The foul attack on Pearl Harbor brought us into the war, and I am unable to see any valid reason why we should be so much more considerate and lenient in dealing with Japan than with Germany. If we do not have available a sufficient number of atomic bombs with which to finish the job immediately, let us carry on with TNT and firebombs until we can produce them. This was total war as long as our enemies held all the cards. Why should we change the rule now, after the blood, treasure, and enterprise of the American people have given us the upper hand?" Truman sent Russell a heartfelt answer written that same day, August 9th. "I know that Japan is a terribly cruel and uncivilized nation in warfare, but I can't bring myself to believe that because they are beasts, we should ourselves act in that same manner. For myself, I certainly regret the necessity of wiping out whole populations because of the pig-headedness of the leaders of a nation, and for your information, I am not going to do it unless it is absolutely necessary. It is my opinion that after the Russians enter into the war, the Japanese will very shortly fold up. My object is to save as many American lives as possible, but I also have a human feeling for the women and children of Japan." That night, in his radio address on Potsdam, he made a point of urging all Japanese civilians to leave the industrial cities immediately and save themselves. "I realize the tragic significance of the atomic bomb," he told the American people. "Its production and its use were not lightly undertaken by this government, but we knew that our enemies were on the search for it. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. Having found the bomb, we have used it. We have used it against those who attacked us without warning at Pearl Harbor, against those who have starved and beaten and executed American prisoners of war, against those who have abandoned all pretense of obeying international laws of warfare. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us. Reflecting on the future and this new force, he said with feeling, "It is an awful responsibility which has come to us." On the morning Nagasaki was bombed, a crucial meeting of Japan's Supreme Council for the Direction of the War had been taking place in Prime Minister Suzuki's bomb shelter outside the Imperial Palace in Tokyo. The meeting was deadlocked, with three powerful military commanders, two generals and one admiral, arguing fervently against surrender. It was time now to lure the Americans ashore. General Anami, the war minister, called for one last great battle on Japanese soil, as demanded by the national honor, as demanded by the honor of the living and the dead. "Would it not be wondrous for this whole nation to be destroyed like a beautiful flower?" he asked. But when news of Nagasaki was brought in, the meeting was adjourned to convene again with the emperor that night in the Imperial Library. In the end, less than 24 hours after Nagasaki, it was Hirohito who decided. They must, he said, bear the unbearable and surrender. The Japanese government would accept the Potsdam Declaration with the understanding that the emperor would remain sovereign. Truman had been up early, as usual, the morning of Friday, August 10th, and was about to leave his private quarters when, at 6:30, a War Department messenger arrived with the radio dispatch. Burns, Stimson, Leahy, and Forrestal were summoned for a meeting at 9 o'clock. "Could we continue the emperor and yet expect to eliminate the warlike spirit in Japan?" Truman later wrote. "Could we even consider a message with so large a but as the kind of unconditional surrender we had fought for?" Stimson, as he had before, said the emperor should be allowed to stay. He thought it the only prudent course. Leahy agreed. Burns was strongly opposed. He wanted nothing less than unconditional surrender, the policy Roosevelt and Churchill had agreed to at the Casablanca Conference in 1943, and he was certain the American people felt the same. The Big Three had called for unconditional surrender at Potsdam, he reminded them. He could not understand why now we should go further than we were willing to go at Potsdam, when we had no atomic bomb and Russia was not in the war. Truman asked to see the Potsdam statement. Forrestal thought that perhaps with different wording the terms could be made acceptable, and this appealed to Truman. He decided against Burns. He decided, as he recorded in his diary, that if the Japanese wanted to keep their emperor, then we'd tell them how to keep him. The official reply, as worded by Burns, stated that the emperor would remain, but subject to the supreme commander of the Allied powers. If it was not unconditional surrender, it was something very close to it. Exactly as Naotaki Sato, the Japanese ambassador in Moscow, had warned Tokyo it would be a month before. At a cabinet meeting that afternoon, Truman reported these developments in strictest confidence. The Allied governments were being notified. Meantime, he had ordered no further use of atomic bombs without his express permission. One more bomb was available at the time. The thought of wiping out another city was too horrible, he said. He hated the idea of killing all those kids. To Henry Wallace, afterward, Truman complained of dreadful headaches for days.
"Physical or figurative?" Wallace asked.
"Both," Truman replied. Attlee cabled his approval that evening, but the Australians were adamantly opposed. "The Emperor should have no immunity from responsibility for Japan's acts of aggression. Unless the system goes, the Japanese will remain unchanged, and recrudescence of aggression in the Pacific will only be postponed to a later generation," said the Australians, who had been excluded from Potsdam and who had fought long and suffered greatly in the war with Japan. At the same time, shattering news was released in Washington, reminding the country that the war continued. On the night of July 29th, the USS Indianapolis, the ship that had delivered the core of the Hiroshima bomb to Tinian, was torpedoed by a Japanese submarine. The ship sank in minutes, taking hundreds of its crew with it and leaving hundreds more drifting in the sea. They were there for days, many eaten by sharks. By the time rescue ships arrived, 800 lives had been lost. Chiang Kai-shek cabled his agreement the next morning, Saturday, August 11th, and so reluctantly did the Australians. The Soviets appeared to be stalling in the hope of having some say in the control of Japan and to drive farther into Manchuria, but eventually, Stalin, too, agreed. A formal reply was transmitted to Tokyo. Then the wait began. Bess Truman had arrived at the White House from Independence. After an absence of more than 2 months, a semblance of normal domestic life had resumed. On Sunday, Truman was at his desk writing a letter. It was his sister's birthday. He would have written sooner, he told her, but he had been too busy. "Nearly every crisis seems to be the worst one, but after it's over, it isn't so bad." To reporters, his composure was extraordinary. He took it all, the drama and the tenseness, the waiting and watching of war's end, in cool stride, markedly lacking in showmanship and striking for its matter-of-factness. Secretary Burns, who kept coming and going from the somber old State Department building next door, seemed a little frantic by contrast. Rumors were everywhere. Peace was imminent. Crowds had gathered outside, expecting an announcement any moment. But Sunday passed without word from the Japanese, and so did Monday, the 13th. Truman confided to his staff that he had ordered General Marshall to resume the B-29 raids. Late in the day, Charlie Ross told reporters the staff would remain on duty until midnight. The wait continued the next morning. It began like the days that had preceded it. Reporters and correspondents jamming the press room and lobby, some of them worn and tired after hours of waiting and from the tenseness of the waiting and uncertainty, wrote Eben Ayers. The crowds outside grew noticeably larger by the hour. Across Pennsylvania Avenue, thousands of people filled Lafayette Square, the majority of them servicemen and women in summer uniforms. The answer reached the president at 4:05 that afternoon, Tuesday, August 14th. Japan had surrendered. At 6:10, the Swiss chargé d'affaires in Washington arrived at the State Department to present Secretary Burns with the Japanese text, which Burns carried at once to the White House. The document would have arrived 10 minutes sooner but for the fact that a 16-year-old messenger, Thomas E. Jones, who picked it up at the RCA offices on Connecticut Avenue to deliver it to the Swiss legation, had been stopped by the police for making a U-turn on Connecticut. Just before 7 p.m., reporters jammed into Truman's office for the announcement. Truman stood behind his desk. Seated beside him, or standing in back, were Burns, Leahy, Bess, most of the cabinet, and Sue Gentry of the Independence Examiner, who happened to be in town and had accepted an invitation to tea with Bess that afternoon. Truman had told her to stick around because she might get a story. He'd just been for a swim, she remembered. And I thought, isn't it wonderful that he could be relaxed and go take a swim? It was still bright daylight outside because of the summer clock. In Lafayette Square, at least 10,000 people were congregated, held in check only by a thin line of police barriers and military police along Pennsylvania Avenue. Truman looked crisp and formal in a double-breasted navy blue suit, blue shirt, silver and blue striped tie with matching handkerchief. There was some shuffling among the reporters. Truman, smiling, said hello to one or two. A Secret Service man announced, "All in." Klieg lights were turned on for the newsreel cameras. Truman glanced at the clock. At exactly 7, his shoulders squared, he began reading slowly and clearly from a sheet of paper held in his right hand. "I have received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government. I deem this reply a full acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan." General MacArthur had been appointed the Supreme Allied Commander to receive the surrender. The reporters charged for the door. Truman and Bess returned to the living quarters, but the celebration outside kept growing. In Grandview, Missouri, in the living room of her small, clabbered house, Martha Ellen Truman excused herself to take a long-distance phone call in another room. "Hello? Hello?" a guest heard her begin. "Yes, I'm all right. Yes, I've been listening to the radio. Yes, I'm all right. Now you come and see me if you can." "Yes, all right. Goodbye." "That was Harry," she said, returning through the door. "Harry's a wonderful man. I knew he'd call. He always calls me after something that happens is over." In Lafayette Square, someone had started a conga line. Within minutes, throngs of people had broken past the barriers and MPs and surged across the street to crowd the length of the White House fence. Streetcars and automobiles stranded in the mob were quickly covered with sailors in white, who clamored